Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Good evening, John. Good evening.
And welcome to this continuing Tuesday evening class. Tony Lisi and I do a regular Tuesday evening class, and we have been doing it this term on a poetical work called The Stanzas of Xian. Now, we have, last week we finished, the stanzas of Xian come in two parts. The first part has seven stanzas, and last week we finished stanza five. As it happens, this is a good point to take a little pause, because in stanza six, in the middle of stanza six, we go into a new direction. It's very strange. It suddenly changes the direction it goes. So this is a good time to take a little pause, and we welcome our elder hostelers who have joined us this evening. And so for them and for regular attenders, we're going to do a little review this evening, which will look at the whole matter, including the first five stanzas. As I said, this is a good time to do it. So let me begin by talking just a little bit about what the stanzas are before we actually get into talking, doing a kind of review of the first five. And by way of an introduction to that, let me just remind everybody that the Theosophical Society is a non-dogmatic organization. It's one which encourages everybody, its own members and everybody else, to explore possibilities and to look for truth wherever it can be found and to value it wherever it can be found. But that doesn't mean that there is not a body of teachings which is called theosophy, because there is. And that body of teachings has the form it does mainly because of articulations or expressions of that teaching which have been made since the last quarter of the 19th century. The society was founded in 1875, and since then theosophists have been talking about theosophy. It is not something new. It has always been claimed that theosophy is in fact the ancient wisdom. It's something which has been around forever, and all we're doing is restating it in certain terms for contemporary times. The major work, the primary book in the statement of this tradition, is a work by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky called The Secret Doctrine, which was published in 1888. And that work is, in fact, a commentary on an ancient creation myth, a poetic creation myth, which is called The Stanzas of Xian. Now, there's something funny about the book itself. It's called The Secret Doctrine, but it was published in 1888 and has never been out of print since. So how secret can it be? Well, that's a very important thing to understand, what secret means there. And to some extent, what secret means there is indicated by the name of this poetic myth, which the whole book is a commentary on, The Stanzas of Xian. Now, Xian is a word which is derived from a Sanskrit word, and the Sanskrit word is jhana. And jhana in Sanskrit means meditation. It is, in fact, the word from which also the Chinese word chan is derived and the Japanese word zen, right? So chan, zen, dhyana, xian are all the same word. So these are really stanzas of meditation. And that gives you a kind of clue to what kind of secret is being talked about. In life, perhaps the most important things we experience, all of us, are incommunicable. We can't talk about them, simply because there is no way to put them into words. And again, this is not something which is terribly mystical, actually. A basic notion of theosophy is that there is no distinction between the sacred and the secular, right? Between the mystical and the ordinary. They're all the same thing, really. It's all one reality. And we have some seats right up here. So that it's easy to illustrate this with a very simple little thing, which some of the people in the class will know because we've done it before. But if you all, everybody here has tasted a lemon in some time in their lives, would you please for just a moment for me, imagine you are biting into a slice of lemon. Your teeth are going through the flesh of the lemon and the juice is spurting out over your tongue. Would you imagine that for me, please? And what's going on right now, please? If you're doing it properly, you're salivating, right? Now, you are salivating because you have tasted a lemon, right, in the past. So you know what that experience is. And you and I can talk about it because we have both had the experience, right? So I can use some words which will trigger in you a memory of an experience which you had. But in fact, the taste of a lemon is incommunicable, right? I really can't tell you what a lemon tastes like. I can describe it poetically, right? I can say some things which may remind you of what it is. But if you had never tasted a lemon in all of your life, you wouldn't have salivated when I talked about that. And I have no way of telling you what a lemon tastes like. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
That is to say, certain experiences are incommunicable because they are unique. Now that's what is secret in the secret doctrine. All right? It is talking about certain experiences which one can have through meditation, the stances of Dzogchen. And those experiences are in themselves incommunicable. They cannot be related cognitively. They can't be put down in words, not even in sacred languages. But if you have had the experience, we can talk about it metaphorically. And the metaphors will trigger in both of us the recollection of the experience. That's what's secret about the secret doctrine. Huh? It's secret because it can't be told. Right? Now, these stanzas on which the book is based are, as I said, a creation myth. And creation myths are found all over the world. Every culture has myths about how the world came to be, right, in the beginning. And we might wonder why that is. Well, it is for a very good reason. Some of us were talking earlier. Human beings who are creatures who are imbued with a passion for meaning, right, for making sense out of experience. And we do this all the time. And again, there's nothing particularly mystical about this. It is just a fact of our nature. My wife and I spend a lot of our time doing proofreading because all of our married lives we have been involved in periodical and book publication. And we try to do proofreading. Do you have any idea how hard it is to catch errors in material? It's extraordinarily hard, and it's hard because when you read something, you are not in fact looking at every letter or every word. You see just enough to project onto the page what you know should be there, right? And what you actually see is what you think ought to be there, not what's there. Right? So that proofreading involves a very special kind of reading in which you have to turn off normal reading process and go into something, quite a different procedure. We project constantly on the world. Another quick illustration of this fact is this. What is on the board? A star. Yeah, that's the answer I want. Thank you. But you will also immediately know that that's wrong, right? There is no star on the board. What's on the board are five angles, right? But you fill in, right? The space, that is to say, the star is in your mind. It's not on the board, right? We project it out of past experience indeed, but we take clues and respond to them. And that we do all the time. It is a normal kind of activity for us. So we are interested in the big question of what the world means, right? And our worlds are us, isn't that right? You know, basically, we're interested in ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. So we want to know who we are, right? And where we are, and why in the name of heaven we're here. And if we're interested in those questions, then how we got here, how this place came to be, becomes an important question. So there is a fascination with origin myths, and hence we get origin myths in every culture. All right, the stanzas of Xian are a creation myth about how the world came into existence. A highly metaphorical, a highly poetic one. Now, just as we are interested, typically, in creation myths, not just because we want to know how the world came to be, we may have an intellectual curiosity about that, but ultimately, why are we interested in where the world came from? Because we're here, right? We want to know what our place in it is. We want to know how it affects us. So every good creation myth has implications for the individual and the individual's life and experience. And that's true of the creation myth of the stanzas of Xian, too. So what Tony and I would like to do this evening is to go over the first five stanzas, talking in general terms about what goes on in each of those stanzas, and then making some comments about how that is relevant to us, what the implications of that stanza are for our life and our response to the world.
And to approach it, we thought we would, again, so much of the wisdom of the world has been conveyed orally in the past, not only through the written records. And so we thought we would play a reading of the first five stanzas. And again, I just would think of you maybe sort of taking yourself back around a campfire or in a cave if you'd like to, or whatever it is, to some place that's quiet and without a lot of distractions, and see what comes through as you hear these first five stanzas, and then we'll get into them.
Cosmic Evolution, in seven stanzas, translated from the Book of Xian. Stanza 1. The Eternal Parent, wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, had slumbered once again for seven eternities. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration. Universal mind was not, for there were no Ahi to contain it. The seven ways to bliss were not. The great causes of misery were not, for there was no one to produce and get ensnared by them. Darkness alone filled the boundless all, for father, mother, and son were once more one, and the sun had not awakened yet for the new wheel and his pilgrimage thereon. The seven sublime lords and the seven truths had ceased to be, and the universe, the sun of necessity, was immersed in Paranishpana, to be outbreathed by that which is and yet is not. Naught was. The causes of existence had been done away with, the visible that was and the invisible that is, rested in eternal non-being, the one being. Alone, the one form of existence, stretched boundless, infinite, causeless, in dreamless sleep. And life pulsated unconscious in universal space, throughout that all-presence which is sensed by the opened eye of the Dhamma. But where was the Dhamma when the Alaya of the universe was in Paramartha and the great wheel was Anupataka? Stanza 2. Where were the builders, the luminous sons of Manvantaric Dawn? In the unknown darkness, in their Ahi Paranishpana, the producers of form from no form, the root of the world, the Deva Matri and Svabhavat rested in the bliss of non-being. Where was silence? Where the ears to sense it? No, there was neither silence nor sound, naught save ceaseless eternal breath, which knows itself not. The hour had not yet struck. The ray had not yet flashed into the germ. The Matripadma had not yet swollen. Her heart had not yet opened for the one ray to enter, thence to fall as three into four into the lap of Maya. The seven suns were not yet born from the web of light. Darkness alone was father, mother, Svabhavat, and Svabhavat was in darkness. These two are the germ, and the germ is one. The universe was still concealed in the divine thought and the divine bosom. Stanza 3. The last vibration of the seventh eternity thrills through infinitude. The mother swells, expanding from within without, like the bud of the lotus. The vibration sweeps along, touching with its swift wing the whole universe and the germ that dwelleth in darkness, the darkness that breathes over the slumbering waters of life. Darkness radiates light, and light drops one solitary ray into the mother deep. The ray shoots through the virgin egg. The ray causes the eternal egg to thrill and drop the non-eternal germ, which condenses into the world egg. Then the three fall into the four. The radiant essence becomes seven inside, seven outside. The luminous egg, which in itself is three, curdles and spreads in milk-white curds throughout the depths of mother, the root that grows in the depths of the ocean of life. The root remains, the light remains, the curds remain, and still O Yahu is one. The root of life was in every drop of the ocean of immortality. And the ocean was radiant light, which was fire and heat and motion. Darkness vanished and was no more. It disappeared in its own essence, the body of fire and water, or father and mother. Behold, O Lanu, the radiant child of the two, the unparalleled, refulgent glory, bright space. Son of dark space, which emerges from the depths of the great dark waters. It is O Yahu, the younger thee. He shines forth as the sun. He is the blazing divine dragon of wisdom. The one is four, and four takes to itself three, and the union produces the Sapta, in whom are the seven which become the Tridasa, or the hosts and the multitudes. Behold him lifting the veil and unfurling it from east to west. He shuts out the above and leaves the below to be seen as the great illusion. He marks the places for the shining ones and turns the upper into a shoreless sea of fire and the one manifested into the great waters. Where was the germ and where was now darkness? Where is the spirit of the flame that burns in thy lamp, O Lanu? The germ is that, and that is light, the white, brilliant sun of the dark, hidden father. Light is cold flame, and flame is fire, and fire produces heat, which yields water, the water of life in the great mother. Father, mother, spin a web whose upper end is fastened to spirit, the light of the one darkness, and the lower one to its shadowy end, matter. And this web is the universe spun out of the two substances made in one, which is Svabhavat. It expands when the breath of fire is upon it. It contracts when the breath of the mother touches it. Then the sons dissociate and scatter, to return into their mother's bosom at the end of the great day, and re-become one with her. When it is cooling, it becomes radiant, and the sons expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. They embrace infinitude. Then Svabhavat sends Fohat to harden the atoms. Each is a part of the web, reflecting the self-existent Lord like a mirror. Each becomes in turn a world. Stanza 4. Listen, ye sons of the earth, to your instructors, the sons of the fire. Learn, there is neither first nor last, for all is one. Number issued from no number. Learn what we who descend from the primordial seven, we who are born from the primordial flame, have learned from our fathers. From the effulgency of light, the ray of the ever darkness, sprang in space the reawakened energies, the one from the egg, the six, and the five, then the three, the one, the four, the one, the five, the twice seven, the sum total. And these are the essences, the flames, the elements, the builders, the numbers, the arupa, the rupa, and the force of divine man, the sum total. And from the divine man emanated the forms, the sparks, the sacred animals, and the messengers of the sacred fathers within the holy four. This was the army of the voice, the divine mother of the seven. The sparks of the seven are subject to and the servants of the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh of the seven. These sparks are called spheres, triangles, cubes, lines, and modelers. For thus stands the eternal Nidana, the O-Yahu, which is darkness, the boundless, or the no number, Adi Nidana Svabhavat. 1. The Adi Sanat, the number, for he is one. 2. The voice of the Lord Svabhavat, the numbers, for he is one and nine. 3. The formless square. And these three enclosed within the circle are the sacred four. And the 10 are the Arupa universe. Then comes the sons, the seven fighters, the one, the eighth left out, and his breath, which is the light maker. Then the second seven, who are the Lipikas, produced by the three. The rejected son is one. The sun sons are countless. Stanza 5. The primordial seven, the first seven breaths of the dragon of wisdom, produce in their turn from their holy circumgyrating breaths the fiery whirlwind. They make of him the messenger of their will. The dew becomes Fohat, the swift son of the divine sons, whose sons are the Lipikas, runs circular errands. Fohat is the steed, and the thought is the rider. He passes like lightning through the fiery clouds, takes three and five and seven strides through the seven regions above and the seven below. He lifts his voice and calls the innumerable sparks and joins them. He is their guiding spirit and leader. When he commences work, he separates the sparks of the lower kingdom that float and thrill with joy in their radiant dwellings, and forms therewith the germs of wheels. He places them in the six directions of space, and one in the middle, the central wheel. Fohat traces spiral lines to unite the sixth to the seventh, the crown. An army of the sons of light stands at each angle, and the Lipikas in the middle wheel. They say, this is good. The first divine world is ready. The first is now the second. Then the divine Arupa reflects itself in Chahaya Loka, the first garment of the Anupadaka. Fohat takes five strides and builds a winged wheel at each corner of the square for the four holy ones and their armies. The Lipikas circumscribe the triangle, the first one, the cube, the second one, and the pentacle within the egg. It is the ring called Pass Not for those who descend and ascend. Also for those who during the Kalpa are progressing towards the great day, be with us. Thus were formed the Rupa and the Arupa. From one light, seven lights. From each of the seven, seven times seven lights. The wheels watch the ring.
All right. Everybody understand all of that?
No.
Does it remind you of your first few years on Earth at all?
Okay. The first stanza, if there is a word in that stanza which is sort of the key word to it, the word is not. Because the stanza is talking about not a time, because there's no time that it's talking about. It's talking about a condition. Well, not a condition, because there are no conditions then. It's the complete negation. It is the existence of no thing, right? Here it's a little bit like the tradition in the Kabbalah, the Jewish mysticism, where the question is asked, what is there behind all of this world, all of these manifold existences that we see? Well, what's behind all of them? And the answer is, the unlimited light. Ansar 4. And okay, very good. What's behind the unlimited light? Well, behind the unlimited light is the unlimited. Oh, I see. What's behind the unlimited? Well, behind the unlimited is the un. The not. The paradox here is that this condition or state of no thingness is actually the state of infinite potentiality, right? There is no, the existence of anything implies a limitation, right? Because anything which is because of what it is not. Isn't that right? You know, a book is a book because it's not a pencil. We define things in terms of
what they are not.
And this state we're talking about is where there are no limitations. Hence, there are no things in it, but the potential is there for everything. Right? It's the state before the world comes into existence, before the cosmos does.
The thing that struck me in that first stanza was dreamless sleep. Could you expound on that somewhat?
This probably reflects a kind of Indian psychology in which it is said that there are four states of consciousness. There is our normal waking consciousness. And here too, there's a kind of paradox involved, because we think of our normal waking consciousness as being the most intense form of consciousness. And this theory says that actually it's the least intense form. In addition to it, there is the dream state, right? Which is all full of Kevin knows what. Right? And beyond the dream state, there is the dreamless sleep. Right? Now, we normally think we are unconscious in the dreamless state, but this view of Indian psychology says, no, that's not true. Actually, we are conscious without limitations in that dreamless state. And it's only the limitations which we remember on things. But that isn't actually the most intense awareness. It's just that we don't recall it when we get back in our ordinary brain minds. And actually beyond that, there's still a fourth state, which is even less limited than dreamless sleep. But that's the sort of thing which I think is being talked about, right? Okay.
But you can't have a dream without some forms in it.
Exactly.
So that if we have nothing,
right,
not.
It has to be a dreamless sleep. All right. Now, what's the point of this as far as we're concerned? Well, actually, this has a very significant implication for you and for me. Because what the stanzas of Dzogchen are saying is that it is out of this dreamless sleep state, it is out of this not state, that everything comes, including us, and that we are all expressions of that, and we all have that in us. At our core, at the core of our being, that is what is there. And that is, in a sense, no thing, but in another sense, it is all potential. So we have within us the potential of everything. And now we get to my favorite modern American myth, the Wizard of Oz. The point of the Wizard of Oz is exactly what I have just said. The essence, the core, the central message of the Wizard of Oz is that each of us has within us the ability to do and to be whatever we want to do and be. We have infinite potential within us. Everybody remember the movie at least, right? Dorothy can go home anytime she wants, right? That's what she gets told in the end by Glinda. The Tin Woodman has all of the heart there is. He may not have a physical beating heart, but he's got all of the heart there is. The Scarecrow's got all of the wisdom in the world, and the Cowardly Lion has got all of the bravery in the world. We all have in us what we need. Incidentally, that's why that book gets banned in some school systems around the country, where some of our fundamentalist friends become dominant. They say they ban the book because it's got good witches in it, and there can't be any good witches. Witches are all bad. But that's trivial. The real reason is it says that you don't need a mediator, right? That each of us has direct contact with that world of no limitation. And we can bring it through into our lives. All right, so it's the first stanza is a statement about what is there for us. Tony, you want to comment on anything on
this one? Again, okay. Night being the other word, the darkness, not
the darkness,
not.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Zero.
The key word in the second stanza, a key phrase, is not yet. Otherwise, the condition in the second stanza sounds a lot like the condition in the first stanza. But there is the implication that it's going to change. Right? It hasn't changed yet, but it's going to. So that the feeling of the second stanza is one of anticipation. Right? One of change hasn't started, but we know it's going to. And this represents, I think, within us, within our own psychology, the fact of intention. Before we do anything, we have to have an intention to do it. We have to frame the thought that we're going to do it. And that's what the second stanza is about. It is framing the intention to bring the world into existence, although it has not yet come. Okay, the third stanza is a particularly interesting one. It's longer than the first two. And its theme, the word is not used in it, but the theme of the third stanza is gestation. And if you were listening carefully to it, you will have noticed when it was there that all of the imagery in it is of impregnation and of pregnancy and of expansion and growth and gestation, right? That's what it's about. Because before the world gets born, there has to be a process of its gestating. So remember, the first stanza begins with, the eternal parent wrapped in her ever-invisible robes had slumbered once again for seven eternities. Well, by the third stanza, she's pregnant. Right?
By the moonbeam. Well, not moonbeam.
No. Ray. The ray. And the imagery in this is of masculine, feminine, and the child which is produced from these interactions. Now, this too, I think, has rather direct implications for us, because really what's being talked about here, in one sense, is the process that is sometimes called the dialectic process. We have an observer, right? And if you have an observer, what else do you have to have? What does the existence of an observer automatically imply?
Something
which is observed, right? And if you have an observer and something which is observed, there is a third thing automatically which is implied, and that is the act of observation, right? Which unites the two. Anytime you have one thing, you automatically have its opposite. We mentioned earlier, to light a candle is to cast a shadow, right? Anytime you have one thing, you have its opposite. And as soon as you have two things, you always have a third which synthesizes them, right? Or which brings them together, or which is their consequence. Now this too is, in fact, very important for our ordinary lives, let me suggest. The act of observation changes both the observer and the thing observed. Mm-hmm. It's easy to see, I think, that observation changes the observer, right? If you observe something, you can never be the same again. Is that not true? Having bitten into that lemon, you can never unbite it, right? You can never forget what a lemon tastes like. That observation has changed you permanently. Now, it may not be so obvious that the act of observing changes the thing which is observed, but modern physicists tell us that is so. They're talking about subatomic particles, right? But observing the thing changes the thing which is observed, right? It does not exist apart from the observer. It is what it is because of the way it has been observed. And of course, the classic example of this in physics is the matter of light. People have always been fascinated with light. It's such a central part and so symbolically so important. But what is light? You know, well, as you all will know, I'll just repeat this very briefly. There are two ways of looking at light, right? According to one way of looking at it, light is a bunch of teensy little particles, photons, right? Very bitty little things. And another way of looking at it, light is a wave phenomenon. Right? Now, what is light really? A wave or a particle? Depends on how you look at it, right? You look at it one way, it's a wave. You look at it the other way, it's a particle. In effect, what it is changes according to how you observe it. Right? Okay, now that happens, that works on the subatomic level, but let me suggest it also works in everyday life. Then, the thing which you observe is what you have observed, right? Your observation has changed it for you, right? Do two people who observe the same thing have the same observation?
No.
And consequently, the thing is, in fact, for them, experientially, and that's all that is, right? Our experience of things, ultimately. Right? You know, what's the Ding an sich? What are things in themselves, apart from being observed? Well, you know, modern physics tells us they ain't nothing, right? They're Schrodinger's cat. You know that little bit. Things exist only as we observe them, for us. Right? And what they are depends on the manner in which we observe them. And that is the creative act. The observation of things creates the thing observed. And that is the basic act of creation. Now, this is, again, not just theory. This is extraordinarily important and extraordinarily practical on a very basic level. The world which I observe, the world around me, is as I observe it. If I expect the world to be a dull and nasty and boring and wicked place, what will the world around me be?
Exactly.
That.
Right.
And if I expect the world to be a place of excitement and of joy and of richness and of potential, what will it be?
That.
It will be that, right? Does the world change according to the way we observe it? The world which we observe, and that's all that exists for us, is our observation, right? Yeah, so is that not a creative act? How we observe the world changes the world for us, right? And that is a creative act. And that's what this stanza is talking about, right? And that's what all of that sexual imagery, or that it's sexual imagery in the sense of pregnancy imagery, I think is talking about. We grow the world inside of us. So stanza 3 is about gestation, about makings. The fourth stanza is about archetypes. Because when we grow the world, when we make the world, we make it according to certain patterns. Right? Our observations are according to certain basic patterns. And so the fourth stanza is about those patterns, the archetypes of reality, according to which we, in fact, are going to form our worlds. And this stanza plays around with two kinds of images for these archetypes. One of them is language, and the other is mathematics. Right? And the language metaphor here talks about, actually, the stanza itself doesn't, it's some of the commentary which explains this, all right, things that are in the stanza. Talks about spirit, voice, and word as three aspects of the coming into existence of things. Now, that's rather nice, actually, because that's very linguistic. You all, my background is linguistics, so you'll just have to pardon my enthusiasm for these things. The word spirit is, of course, from Latin, spiritus. But the basic meaning of spiritus, the etymological meaning of spiritus in Latin is the breath. And that's not limited to Latin, because we get that in a lot of languages. In Hebrew, the word which corresponds to spirit is ruach. But ruach means breath, literally. Right? So that notion of, and the same thing is true in Sanskrit, where the basic, where the word for spirit is atma. But atma basically means breath. Huh? So spirit and breath are somehow closely associated in many cultures across the world. And this works real nicely with respect to language, because remember we were saying this morning, Elder Hostlers, that language is basically spoken, right? Not written, that written is just simply something added on. It's basically speech. And all speech is made with the breath, right? Now, normally when we breathe in and we breathe out, and there is no noise, right? Unless we happen to have some physical abnormality or some physical problem. But, right, normally it's completely silent. But the breath is the basis for which language operates. Now, what we can do as we breathe in and out is something with our vocal cords down here. Vocal cords are two little muscles on either side of the windpipe, right here where I've got an Adam's apple. And if while I'm breathing in and out, I begin to hold those vocal cords very taut. Ordinarily in my breathing, they're loose. They're just relaxed. But if I tighten them up, they come very close together. They don't come all the way together. They get very close together and very tight. And as the air passes between them, they begin to vibrate. And when they vibrate, this is what happens. And that is called voice, right? That's the technical term for it in linguistics. Voice is the vibration of the vocal cords. Actually, you can't get voice all alone. You have to do something else to get it. But that's all right. That's the point is made. Huh? Now, again, is not much, right? But it's voice. Now, if I begin to do other things, if I begin to articulate, and articulate means to divide, right? To chop up. If I begin to divide or articulate by doing other things with my vocal organs, with my tongue and the other things in there, the interior plumbing and my head, I will get all sorts of other things. I will get not just or I will get, well, nice to see you this evening. Right? I will get words, right? Words are articulations of the voice, of the breathing. So that we are moving now, as it were, from the unmanifest, right? The breathing, through the first manifestation, which is the voice, into the articulation of the word. And is the spoken word, is saying the word, a symbol of creation in a lot of world mythologies?
In the beginning was the word.
In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God, right? In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and there was void without form, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the darkness, and God said, let there be light. Right? It was a mess. It was just all darkness and void, right? Until God said, let there be light. Okay, so the notion of speaking is bringing the world into existence. And this is exactly the kind of thing we were talking about in the case of observation. Right? As we talk about the world, so is it. We make our world by talking about it, and by the way we're talking about it. And this is a point which was very much made by a linguist by the name of Benjamin Lee Whorf, who actually was a theosophist. So traditional linguists don't like to talk about Whorf anymore, or what is called the Whorf hypothesis, because traditional linguists regard themselves as scientists. They aren't, but they think they are. And like any good scientist, they want to have things which they can test, right? Which you can disprove. And the Whorf hypothesis turns out to be untestable, i.e. you cannot disprove it. And because you can't disprove it, then it's, in the jargon of the trade, uninteresting. But in fact, a lot of linguists are extraordinarily interested in the Whorf hypothesis, and there was just a book published last year about it again. There are closet Whorfians all through the linguistic world, and they keep peeking out of their closets. Whorf's hypothesis was that the language we speak affects, in fact, perhaps determines, the way we perceive reality. And if we speak different languages, we perceive reality differently, because the language we talk directs our attention to different aspects of reality. And my favorite, some of you have been around before, you'll have to forgive me if I repeat myself. I've only got so many examples, right? So many good examples. A good example of this is the fact that in English, as indeed most Indo-European languages, every time you say a complete sentence, you have to say something about time, because sentences have verbs in them. And in English and in other Indo-European languages, tense is an inherent characteristic of all verbs. So that I can say I am, or I can say I was, right? But in doing that, am I not making a statement about time? Okay. Not all languages are like that. There are languages which do not require you to say anything about time. That's not to say you can't talk about time in those languages. You can. But you are not required by the language to talk about time. And Hebrew happens to be one of those. Not modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew in this respect is a European language. It's an Indo-European language. It's been assimilated to them. Classical Hebrew, biblical Hebrew I'm talking about. In biblical Hebrew, there is no time in the verb. Instead, what is in the verb is the difference between certainty and uncertainty, not time, right? When you use a Hebrew verb, you have to say whether or not the action you are talking about definitely occurred, or whether maybe it occurred, or is occurring, or will occur. Right? Time is not involved. It's the definiteness of the action. And this is really interesting for scriptural matters, because you all remember that Moses ran into a burning bush, right? And one time in the desert. And it was a very peculiar bush, because although it burned, it didn't get consumed, right? It just went right on burning. And it was a peculiar bush in another way, because it talked. Right? Now, how many of you ever seen a burning bush that talked and didn't get burned up? Well, that's sort of an unusual sight. And this bush told Moses to do something, right? It told, you go to Pharaoh, it told Moses, and you tell him to let my people go. And Moses, who was a sensible man, argued back. This is also a good Jewish characteristic. He argued back and he said, I can't do that. If I go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go, he's going to say, who says so? Who are you? And the voice out of the burning bush answered in a very famous statement, which is translated in the King James Version, I am that I am. But in fact, the verb form in Hebrew can't be translated into English, because I am means present time, doesn't it? What the Hebrew verb says is, the fact of my existence is undoubtable. Right? I exist, right? Past, present, and future. It was the definite form of the verb, which is used there. So our language does direct us, right? In different ways. And that maybe is why we who speak English, and indeed who speak any Indo-European language, are time-bound. Right? We're time-obsessed, aren't we? We have to begin on time and end on time. But lots of people just don't care much about time. And so partly our language is a conditioning factor with that respect. All right, so this is the notion of language as something which creates the archetypes or the patterns according to which we respond is a good one. The other one is mathematics, and I'm not going to go into detail on that, because we went 2 weeks ago into great detail on that, and I will put all the regular class members to sleep if I do it all over again, so I'm not going to. But there are two sets of figures which are mentioned, two sets of numbers which are mentioned in this stanza. One of them is perfectly straightforward. One of them is that. And what is that?
Pi.
Pi! That's right, which is the ratio of the diameter of a circle to its circumference. And we talked about that in class, and it's a very interesting, well, it goes on. It's a very interesting number, partly because it does go on. It is an inexhaustible number. An infinite number. It has no end, and it never repeats itself. So it is not predictable. There's no way of predicting what the next digit is. Right? It goes on and on and on. But this unpredictable, inexhaustible number is the basis for figuring the circumference, and indeed also the area, of a circle. Right? A basic note. Now, the other set of numbers in there, I have been puzzled about, and I haven't known what to make of them, but I got a kind of idea that maybe what that other set of numbers is. And the other numbers, the words in the stanza are the one from the egg, the six, and the five. Well, you know, sometimes we sort of get turned around a little bit here. And if we take the one from the egg and put the egg, i.e. the circle, oops, I still got the wrong order, put the circle first and maybe even move the one over a little bit and get 0.615, that is a very close approximation to something known as the golden section. And then have you ever heard of the golden section?
No. Yeah.
No.
Yes.
All right. The golden section is it's a ratio, just like this, and it is also inexhaustible, right? The actual golden section is 0.618, but it's all an approximation, so 0.615 isn't too far off from it. The golden section is just this. If you have a line of that length. You can section it or divide it at a certain point, let's say here, such that the ratio of the shorter section to the longer section is the same as the ratio of the longer section to the whole line. All right? That's what the golden section is. Now, so what? So what? It turns out that that ratio is extraordinarily important in living things. In plants, in animals, the proportions, the relations of one part to another approximate the golden section. It is a kind of universal number, a universal ratio in all of life. Furthermore, it has, you can construct, if I take this shorter section and do it as an upright and make out of it a rectangle, right? Where this is equivalent to that. Right? That's called a golden rectangle. And the golden rectangle is the preferred shape for people. And they done psychological experiments on this, in which they gave people rectangles of different proportions, and they've asked them, which do you like best? Which of those three do you like best? Overwhelmingly, people choose the one which is closest to the golden rectangle, right? To the golden section. This is the pattern of the Parthenon. Right? The front of the Parthenon is a golden rectangle. It was used by Renaissance artists and architects all over the place because it was considered an ideal shape. It is also, you know, the chambered nautilus, the shell that precedes. One of the characteristics of this is that you can sort of divide this golden rectangle into a square plus another rectangle over here, and then you can take, of course, and divide that into a square and another golden rectangle. And you can divide that into a square and another. You can keep on doing this. And then if you draw lines which connect these, what you will get is the shape of the chambered nautilus. That is to say, the spiral shape is generated by the golden section or the golden ratio. It's all through nature. So maybe this one from the egg, the six and the five, it's a very close approximation to the golden section. And maybe that's what's being talked about here. Huh? The pi is, of course, important because the circle is the ideal shape. And the straight line is related to that. But the golden section is important for all of life. So maybe that's what's going on there. I don't know. Maybe. Number five talks about the beginning. Now we've got the archetypes up here, right? The archetypes are linguistic. They are words coming from voice, coming from breath or spirit. Or they are numbers. They are things like pi and maybe the golden section. Number five represents the actual emanation of the world. It talks about the beginning of the creation of the world. And according to the vision of things in the secret doctrine, this happens in three stages or three processes are involved. One is the creation of matter, right? And the second is the molding of matter into forms or shapes which respond to one another, right? And the third is the awakening of self-consciousness in some of those forms. They are referred to as physical evolution, intellectual or formal evolution, and spiritual evolution. And stanza five is about the creation of the material world in its various formal aspects, of which there are seven. So that's sort of a brief summary of what it's about and of some of the implications for us.
I asked earlier if this reminds you at all of your first few years on the planet here, and I'm reminded of Samuel Beckett, who has one of his characters, when frustrated, he describes him that he cursed the day he was born, and in a bold flashback, the moment of his conception. So that when we get into the kind of time element here, you have the not, the, in a sense, what was prior. And in the metaphysics of the sacred doctrine, you have a different kind of metaphysics that I just want to mention, because some of you coming out of philosophy, you'll think of metaphysics in its philosophical sense. The term actually came in the way they were organizing Aristotle's texts, and there was the book that on nature, all the physics, and then this was the book after it, which was really meant to be at first philosophy, the most primary basic categories that we use in understanding our reality. And that became called metaphysics as such. 20th century English metaphysicians will make a distinction then between descriptive metaphysics, which is primarily, again, trying to take a look at what are the most basic categories that we utilize in understanding reality, if you wish, reality being one of them often, time, space. And as we say in this particular first stanza, that's something that's before these concepts, in a sense, have a chance to operate. So descriptive metaphysics then is considered something that very strongly focuses on language. And in 20th century English-speaking philosophy, what's called analytic philosophy or linguistic philosophy, competitors to the terrain that John and the other linguists have, but nonetheless, look at the logic of the language in many similar ways. The sense of there being a contrast theory of meaning that John alluded to, that you really need something based in the language and the conceptual system to contrast things before you have a chance of clarity. The sense of the, again, the observer, the observed, what I was suggesting to this class a few weeks ago, one way of looking at it is in terms of a drama, as Kenneth Burke, one of the thinkers in this tradition, speaks of dramatism. There's a scene, there are actors, agents, counter-agents, you know, those that, again, you mentioned the Wizard of Oz. You have poor Dorothy there trying to get home, and she's got some folks that help her, right? And then she's got some who are providing resistance. And so this is in the area of agents and agency as such. There are also then, again, specific things people can do. I mean, the ruby slippers or the silver slippers, depending on what version you came, clicking them, etc. The winged monkeys that help transport, or balloons, things of these as agencies. Then there are the things that are really very interesting. Again, the purpose. Why are we doing it? Why, you know, why are we trying to get home? Where are we going? Well, it seems to me, again, this system here, in terms of descriptive metaphysics, the contrasting term is in philosophy is revisionary metaphysics, systems that attempt to try to restructure the categories that we use based on some system that is argued for as preferable, more useful, more elegant, more simple, more truthful, whatever you want to do in it. However, and I think, again, to classify this work, this is, to me, what you might, you know, the philosophers wouldn't even classify this, but this would be a mystical, dynamic metaphysic that is drawing, I think, deeper on the unconscious currents within all of us. So let me just suggest again, if we take a look at, you know, not being quite as negative about it as Beckett was, but all of us had some moment of conception, right? In which, you know, I happen to know mine because my mother was very, very careful about those. So, you know, the fact that I always, it allows me to celebrate a second day each year. It's Pearl Harbor Day. So I get to think of that as filled with all sorts of meaning.
Yeah, so your middle name wasn't Tristram Shandy, was
no,
it?
No, I know, but it's a lot like it, a lot like Tristram. But I December 7th is always, you know, again, and there are a lot of other metaphors I won't even get into about that in terms
good.
Of the family. But nonetheless, one of the issues that we're dealing with, if you start saying, okay, well, look at these things that John has up on the board, and you know, how do these relate to our own development? How many specific memories are you able to come up with about the first few years of your life? I don't know, a lot, right? Or maybe some with the help of photographs, photographic albums, testimony of others?
Age 2 3/4, I can remember.
Okay. So that's one of the early events?
Yeah, the early.
Okay. Well, the sense that I think is coming out of the metaphysics, again, asking us, what does this have to do with us? Well, I think that in a certain sense, there are all sorts of unconscious processes that have structure and order, that are dynamic, that go to build up our bodies and our living being. You know, we're really, again, we speak of DNA, we speak of coding, the whole, in a sense, of unfolding of a certain series of events from the moment of conception. Well, these are things in which we're growing. We're on the planet, right? We're certainly dependent on others for our existence for a long period of time. But then we, you know, reach the point of crawling and then eventually stumbling, the toddler years and all. And when we, for example, when we, you know, for those of you who have grandchildren now, put on, you know, Sesame Street or something like that, and what are they going to learn? They're going to learn the letters and they're going to learn the numbers, right? My son was watching TV before I knew that he was learning anything from it, and he was about 13 months when we went on our first flight, and he always reminded me of the critic John. I can't remember the drama critic that was always so brutal out of the New York. Do you remember him at all?
No, I don't. I never read brutal critics.
Anyway, he'd have his thumb in his mouth like a pipe, right from the early picture of him, and then he'd pull it out like a professor and then say something. And so we had our first flight going from Boston to New York, and you know, all of a sudden he looked at me and said, "Why do they have all these exit signs?" You know, and I'm just blown over. Well, where did you learn about exit signs? Well, you learned about it from Sesame Street. But, of course, you went through the numbers. You're building up the numbers. You're building up the letters, the alphabet, all of these little things that start taking the process in which they're encoding a relationship between ourselves and the outer world. So like John's pointing out, the different languages that Worf, other linguists talk about, they do it in different ways with huge kinds of implications. I mean, for example, Madame Blavatsky, in talking about the secret doctrine, really says, again, Sanskrit, that's the language of the gods. You know, that's it. You know, anything else, trying to get it in English, well, don't be irritated by me, because how can you do better? English is an awful language. It's not, certainly not the language of gods. It's the language of the Brits. But nonetheless, it's... So there's the sense of acquiring then the tools that we need to operate in the outside world. And what I would suggest, again, when we start getting into this notion of emanation in five as such, if we start taking this then as being somewhat analogous to processes later in our life, then you've got some interesting kind of psychological data that's collected along the lines in this 20th century. One of the things that you know, we've talked in, about different brain stage growth periods, and these periods, some of you might remember Piaget, the Swiss depth psychologist, in a sense, or developmental psychologist, who again very carefully observed children putting together the world like this. You look at Piaget's books, they're about the concept of causality. When do children start thinking in terms of causality? When do they start thinking in terms of number, or space, or time? These are the successive volumes of Piaget. And there's been all kinds of work done after him, refining his concepts. But pretty much, again, they find that cross-culturally, even with all these social differences that we have, this is the way the human being unfolds in terms of getting the tools to operate in the outside culture. Now, however, in depth psychology, and now we're talking about a different tradition that's more coming through the Freud-Jung matrix, if you wish, is there's a sense that there are things going on that are, in a sense, developmental, but there are things that are, in a sense, transformational, in which they're not automatic, they're not just functions of aging. There's not the sequence themselves. That's why, as we're saying, that's why you can have old fools, because it's not everybody is going to chronologically develop into a wise creature. And the sense is that in the depth psychology paradigm is that there is an interaction going on within us, an unfolding set of cues, a sequencing that's often coming through dreams, often coming through synchronicities, the events, like Dorothy getting picked up by the whirlwind and having her house land on the witch. Things like that happen to us, and these become meaningful shifts in our own life. It's as though something's telling us to do things differently. So the issue of transformation, or evolution in an older sense of the word, is one in which it's not automatic. In the sense it's going to require a sensitive steering between the unconscious that's unfolding on the one plan and your own consciousness. So in a sense, if we only get stuck in number five and get enculturated, then the sense is that there isn't going to necessarily be any change or development socially or physiologically. We're going to repeat the same models over and over again. But thank God for that pi number, right? And thank God for the golden mean. Is these numbers are not things that leave things static. They're dynamic in their very, very essence. And so it seems that, at least say from a Jungian perspective, as in a sense followed through by a lot of cross-cultural research, is that somewhere in the mid-30s is the sort of median time. 10 years plus or minus in its other kinds of extremities, is that suddenly we start getting more receptive to the inner life, inner promptings. And this seems to be happening all over. It's not just us going through the rituals of the religion of our fathers and mothers anymore. Now there's something going on the inside that's getting us to raise some questions, to ask us to do something possibly very different and do some things differently as well. So that the sense is that this is, we don't have to go with it. We can reject it. The old saying, the fates lead the willing and they drag the unwilling. The sense is there's a process that we have the opportunity, if we make the right choices, to be contributing to this grand evolution of the entire universe that we're part of. Because again, we're connected with something that has its very dynamism oriented in that way. But again, we can drag our feet on it and really keep away from it. And so often it seems again that the research suggests that we've come out of a very materialistic time in which we probably have had greater, especially if we grew up thinking we were scientists, like psychologists do and linguists do, is that you're stuck with a scientific method that is really, unless you really explore it deeply and criticize it, it tended to throw out all kinds of things as possibilities that really are still within the domain of science and observation and data collecting. And so there became a very mechanical view of the universe that was accepted, and there was nobody questioning it, and so anybody who didn't share it, anybody who would come in with these woolly notions the universe was sort of going to be dismissed before even having a chance to be heard. Well, at the end of the 20th century, I can say that psychology and science have really moved a long distance from where they were at the beginning of the century. There's been criticism both within all of the fields. There's been a lot of criticism from without, for sure. And the sense is now that the issues of our inner experience, the issues of the sense of prompting, the sense of there being, for example, an inner guide or guardian, angel, if you wish, in certain traditions. Well, now you have people on Oprah talking about that. And the people, this is part of the collective types of concept that are not being accepted merely because, again, somebody's out there saying by this new authority, this is right. It's being accepted because it's fitting people's experience. People are saying, you know, that's the way things have happened for me. That's, I understand this. I'm not sure where it's going. But it's in this sense, again, the dynamic of the secret doctrine, and we're only getting at, you know, five of the stanzas to begin with, is that there's this movement from the, again, the ever existing elements of the universe, these then the sort of pre-existing aspects of potential that are still possible but have not been enacted through the choices and possibilities that we have. And then finally, the aspect of what does get actualized and get expressed in the new culture. And it's in this sense, it's very interesting that Margaret Mead had pointed out that this was the first century in history where the elders were no longer respected as authorities. That the elders were, you know, sort of, you know, again, considered, you know, if you didn't publish it by the time you were 29, in most fields, you were not a good bet for tenure. You know, because, you know, that's just the assumptions that were built into things. There has been, I think, through Elder Hostel, through all sorts of things in this last 25 years, a new shift about that, because it's suggesting that it's, again, the elders who have an opportunity now, maybe, to be in greater touch once again with the realm of potential and to actualize them in your own lives and set a new direction and new vision for younger people that sort of counter that kind of mechanistic, behavioristic vision that, like a wicked witch, it sort of really captured the West as such. So this is part then of the dynamic, and I think what's exciting about this expressing metaphor that is a poetic dynamic foundation for our metaphysics, rather than trying to reason just and come up with concepts as Aristotle and Kant and everyone else did, is I think this is just the thing that animates people. That's why the creation myths have always been very, very important to a culture, because when children learned those myths, again, they found their place in reality, and they found, in a sense, a vision of their responsibility, where they were going to go with it. And so it seems to me that there's been a huge eclipse of that energy in the 20th century based on the kind of materialistic worldview, but that it has been, in a sense, severely challenged in the last 25 years through, again, figures, the work that show the importance of mythology. The Joseph Campbells, the Mercer Eliades, the Carl Jungs, the various people that have written this area, suggest again that we don't really want to think of ourselves as just mere, again, meat puppets. That's a rock group that my son likes, but I think it sums it up pretty well. M-E-A-T-P-U-P-P-E-T-S. Now that's the materialistic worldview. And we're just responding in terms, I mean, we don't even have what the scarecrow had in, to get through his ordeal. But now the sense is, again, that if we see ourselves as sacred beings and we are now understanding the purpose of the unfolding consciousness and our interconnection with all being, then this totally changes the way we would look at the world and the choices that we would make. So, with that, any questions that you might have as we do this recapitulation and review for those who are here? Yeah.
I just want to comment on this. There are two main theories. One is obviously procreative genesis of ourselves, entrance to the physical existence. And then the other one is neoptomy, which is basically discovering our divine spark within us. Basically, yeah, that is sometimes compared to the Adam Kidman, and then obviously Adam recognizing the animals and so forth. Basically something that is out there, all of a sudden through our progressive projection of our thoughts, we knew before. So I guess what I'm trying to really say is that we are, and for philosophical literature, we do learn that we are making progressive way back in terms of our physical existence, in terms of brain capacity increases, so we can, for instance, anticipate the cognizance of the fifth element as we are approaching. And so then we can certainly connect through what we see as the cosmic hierarchy through something that is already existing out there as all-knowing, omnipresent, omniscient. So I think that this is what pretty much the collision of the two theories are. One is, are we strictly maturing through physical existence? Another one is, are we really something more than just the physical? Mm-hmm. And that is really our divine presence, which some obviously argue and some don't. And it's just a matter of state of mind and, you know.
Well, as John mentioned, in terms of the wharf hypothesis, you know, if you look at it empirically, scientifically, the question is, are there ways to falsify either one of those? Is there data to collect? Is there things to support either one? Or are we at a point now, which it seems to me, some of the phenomena that I see socially suggest that people are having certain kinds of intuitions about the inner life, in which they're no longer feeling the need for external kinds of evidence for. I mean, you know, nobody, just like nobody can tell you if you have a toothache or not, I mean, nobody can tell me if I didn't have or have an experience that is different and in a sense of a metanoia, turning around in my life once I have had certain experiences. So, you know, I think it's, again, it's going to be... certainly the conflict isn't over between science of the kind that I'm telling you about and what might be seen as the growing sense of the spiritual rather than the religious. But it seems to me that we're on a different kind of wave now that is certainly more charitable and judging the feeling function aspects, the aspects of love and compassion, those things that aren't easily measurable. In the scientific terms. How does one get convinced when the external conditioning you've had tells you one way? What are the experiences that allow you to say, I don't care, the emperor isn't wearing any clothes? Well, we've hit the time mark. And, yes.
Well, next week, stanza 6, and we go on to the evolution of the Earth system. We get rather specific next week.